Good morning. I'd like to greet you all in Jesus' name this morning. I want to welcome you to Boonville. If you ever come through on I-70, Boonville sits right on I-70. And so occasionally we get the opportunity to help people traveling through. And so we would be glad to have you there. And one thing I find a tremendous blessing wherever I go to preach or interact with God's people. I was thinking about it this morning as the brother shared the devotions, and I thought, you know, this is a very similar devotions that I could have heard at home in Boonville, and it made me feel at home here. And I wasn't so sure yesterday coming across on 5. I didn't know what we would find when we got here. You know, it was a little bit rough coming through there, and I thought, what kind of hick town is this, you know? And well, we made it, but we knew that on the other end, we knew there was God's people here, and so it wasn't so scary as I made it sound. So God bless you for being faithful and for being that witness here. And whenever we center around God's word, we can trust that. That's such a blessing. So the title that was given to me, the subject was Building Together in a Materialistic Age. And it caught me off step a little bit because I had understood that this was going to be for your deacon ordination, and I wasn't quite expecting that train of thought. However, it's very relevant to a deacon ordination, I believe. And so there's a lot of things for us to consider in a subject like this, especially as we consider this deacon ordination coming up. It ties in well, like I said. You know, this deacon is going to have front row seating to scenarios that he didn't ask for and probably doesn't care to be a part of necessarily. There will probably be things that he will struggle with to know how to assist without judging. There's going to be situations where he's going to struggle to know how to help, or maybe not even be able to help unless a heart change takes place. And these things show up in our lives, because when our hearts aren't right with God, then real life scenarios happen. Things that don't work well, like the brother shared about the tangled situations. And there's a lot of scenarios that we could put on the table this morning and that we could learn from. But instead, I want to dig a little deeper and help us understand where our human nature naturally takes us in relation to this subject. And when I get done this morning, you might think, you know, he didn't give us a lot of material to go home with, really practical things that I can take home and build in a materialistic age. But let me tell you a little story to illustrate the direction of thought I'm thinking. One of my friends, one of the brothers in our church at home, is currently putting up a chicken house. And in the county he's in, Cooper County, that lies south of I-70 there, is fairly rocky soil, I think, probably like you all deal with here. And the excavation company came in to excavate for him, and they got down not very far and not deep enough. And they hit some pretty substantial rocks, and they worked that rock down, and they finally got it down to the pad laid in where they could build this building on top of there. And it cost them, he said it cost them, they had to replace a $40,000 set of tracks, and you know, they didn't make money on this job, right? But what I'm trying to tell you is that they had to work through some boulders and get down to base layer so that they could start and do something worthwhile right from there. And that's what I'm trying to say this morning is the point I'm trying to make. And what seemed clear to me about this title is that in order to build successfully in our churches, materialism must be confronted in our lives. And further, once these boulders are removed, I believe that this building of church, building of kingdom, happens organically. It's going to start to happen naturally. You're going to start to see things taking place that seem effortless, maybe. And for a church to be successful in building it, it has to be more than just the deacons that understand this. And so whether you're a potential deacon here or not, You need to understand this concept that we're trying to put forward this morning. Now, I have quite a bit of reading to do in the Bible this morning, and we got to take some time to get this base laid so that we can understand where we're headed. So turn to Exodus 24. Exodus 24, and we need to read the whole chapter here. Exodus 24, verse 1, and he said unto Moses, and this is the Lord, come up unto the Lord, thou, and Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship ye afar off. And Moses alone shall come near the Lord, but they shall not come nigh, neither shall the people go with him. And Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and the judgments, and all the judgments, and all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Lord hath said will we do. And Moses wrote all the words of the Lord, and rose up early in the morning, and built an altar under the hill, and 12 pillars, according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the children of Israel, which offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen unto the Lord. And Moses took half the blood and put it in basins, and half the blood he sprinkled in the altar. And he took the book of the covenant and read in the audience of the people. And they said, all that the Lord has said will we do and be obedient. And Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, behold, the blood of the covenant which the Lord hath made with you concerning all these words. Then went up Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. And they saw the God of Israel, and there was under his feet as it were a paved work of a sapphire stone, and as it were the body of heaven in his clearness. And upon the nobles of the children of Israel he laid not his hand. Also they saw God, and did eat and drink. And the Lord said unto Moses, come up to me into the mount, and be there, and I will give thee tables of stone, and a law and commandments which I have written, that thou mayest teach them. And Moses rose up, and his minister Joshua. And Moses went up into the mount of God, and he said unto the elders, tarry ye here for us until we come again unto you. And behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. If any man have any matters to do, let him come unto them. And Moses went up into the mount, and a cloud covered the mount. And the glory of the Lord abode upon Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And the seventh day he called unto Moses out of the midst of the cloud. And the sight of the glory of the Lord was like devouring fire on the top of the mount in the eyes of the children of Israel. And Moses went into the midst of the cloud and gat him up into the mount. And Moses was in the mount 40 days and 40 nights. And in the next 7 chapters, I believe it is, God spoke with Moses there, and he said, hey, this is how I need to be worshipped this way. And this is how you need to set up the tabernacle. I want the altar over here. I want all this stuff put in place. And it took him 7 chapters to do that. And then turn over to Exodus 32. And we want to read the first 20 verses of Exodus 32 there. Exodus 32, verse 1. And when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, the people gathered themselves together unto Aaron and said unto him, up, make us gods, which shall go before us. For this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we wot not what has become of him. And Aaron said unto them, break off the golden earrings, which are in the ears of your wives, of your sons, and of your daughters, and bring them unto me. And all the people break off the golden earrings, which were in their ears, and brought them unto Aaron. And he received them at their hand, and fashioned it with a graving tool, after he had made it a molten calf. And they said, these be thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. And they rose up early on the morrow and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. And the Lord said unto Moses, go, get thee down, for thy people which thou broughtest out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made them a molten calf, and have worshipped it, and have sacrificed thereunto, and said, these be thy gods, O Israel, which have brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And the Lord said unto Moses, I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Now therefore let me alone, that my wrath may wax hot against them, and that I may consume them, and I will make thee a great nation. And Moses besought the Lord his God and said, Lord, why doth thy wrath wax hot against thy people, which thou hast brought forth out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Wherefore should the Egyptians speak and say, for mischief did he bring them out, to slay them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth? Turn from thy fierce wrath and repent of this evil against thy people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, thy servants, to whom thou swearest by thine own self, and saidest unto them, I will multiply your seed as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I have spoken of will I give unto your seed, and they shall inherit it forever. And the Lord repented of the evil which he thought to do unto his people. And Moses turned and went down from the mount, and the two tables of the testimony were in his hand. The tables were written on both their sides, on the one side and on the other side were they written. And the tables were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God graven upon the tables. And when Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said unto Moses, there is a noise of war in the camp. And he said, it is not the voice of them that shout for mastery, neither is it the voice of them that cry for being overcome, but the noise of them that sing do I hear. And it came to pass, as soon as he came nigh unto the camp, that he saw the calf and the dancing. And Moses' anger waxed hot, and he cast the tables out of his hands and brake them beneath the mountain. And he took the calf which they had made and burned it in the fire and ground it to powder and strawed it upon the water and made the children of Israel drink of it. So here we have this story that we know. We've known for, you know, as we grew up, we heard about this story. We have this story about this golden calf that the Israelites made, or that Aaron made, actually. And this story took place, as best as I can tell, very shortly after God had verbally given them the Ten Commandments. He came down in the mountain and he laid out the Ten Commandments for them. And then Moses went up in the mountain here for 40 days. And then he came down and God wrote them on tables of stone for him. And he come down out of the mountain and right in front of his eyes, what was happening? But they were breaking the very first commandment that God gave them. And we find that this first commandment that God took a lot of time and effort to make sure they got what he was trying to say. One more section we want to read. Turn it back to Exodus 20. Where we'll read the first six verses here. And this is the commandments, and this is where God was speaking to them, the Ten Commandments, before he wrote them on the tables of stone. Exodus 20, and God spake all these words, saying, I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, or any likeness of anything that is in the heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generations of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that keep love me and keep my commandments. And that was the part that God said, don't serve any other gods. He took five verses there to say, don't serve any other gods. And if you read down through the rest of the Ten Commandments, I think it takes another maybe nine verses to finish out the rest of the commandments. But the first commandment, the one about not serving any other gods, it took him some time. And he explained it out and he said, don't serve any other gods. Okay? And make sure that, you know, when you look up at the stars and you see the stars in the heaven and the moon and all that, make sure that you don't worship that. That's not to be worshipped. Worship me. About a third of the Ten Commandments is focused on this, and the other nine commandments takes about two-thirds of the time. And so you see the proportion of God said, you know, pay attention to what I'm saying. Do you understand? You know, sometimes we say that to our children. Do you understand? And when we say that, we mean that they need to pay attention. Do you get what I'm trying to say? That's what God was saying. Don't serve any other gods, right? And so with that much material, we know that this is important to God. And Jesus confirmed that when he was asked about the greatest commandments. He said, thou shalt, you don't serve any other gods. That's the first and greatest commandment. And the very first words that he spoke to right here in Exodus 20, in verse 2, he says, I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt. The Israelites had just been brought out of slavery from a people that served and worshipped everything except the true God. The Egyptians, they worshipped cattle, they worshipped their crops, they worshipped the river, they worshipped Pharaoh. They worshipped whatever it seemed like was handy to worship. And God had systematically targeted these things that they were worshipping with the 10 plagues. He went down the list and he focused on those things and just eradicated their worship system. And then he sent the Israelites out of there, and you would think that would have been enough for them to understand that, make sure I worship God in the right way, right? So God was reaffirming. He said, you just came out of Egypt. That worship back there was mixed up. Know that I am God and you worship me. Not the river, not cows and bulls, not alligators. Make sure you worship me. It doesn't matter how great and fancy and how awesome it looks to you, make sure that I am the focus of your worship. Worship me in this way. He told them very clearly how to worship him. And he said, in fact, don't make any type of graven images of any sort from the highest heaven to the lowest of the earth. Just make sure that you worship me. And then we have this golden calf story. And it just takes the breath out of us a little bit. We think, well, how in the world did they get there? How in the world, right after God took them out of Egypt and took them through the Red Sea and did all these mighty works, and then they show up in the desert or out in the wilderness out there and put up a golden calf and start worshiping. We're like, what happened? And I thought, and you thought, and all the prevailing opinions think that this is just rampant disregard for God and his sovereignty and his wisdom and who God is. And probably in the bare bones analogy of it, that's probably true, right? I'm not here to water down this story this morning, but we need to give these people a little bit of grace. And hopefully we can learn something from this as we work through this morning. Because I want to tell you a little bit of something about the Eastern culture that might change our thinking on this a little bit and help us understand what was actually going on here and why this happened, at least in part. And something that is probably obscure without some study, and for a long time I didn't understand this. But as we read through this story, there's things here that don't seem to line up with the concept that this was just an all-and-out rebellion and that they were hell-bent on doing, you know, wrong. There's some things here, and the couple things that I want to point out specifically is that they came to Aaron, the person that Moses had specifically left in charge. He said, I'm going away. I'm going up in the mountain to talk to God. If you have problems, if you have questions, come talk to Aaron. And that's exactly what these people did. Why didn't they go out in the gully somewhere, out in the backfield, back behind the row of trees or whatever, and set up this, you know, do their thing back there and music and dancing and all the things that Moses heard when he came down out of the mountain? Why wasn't it out back somewhere? They came to the leader. They came to the one that they had been directed to come to if they had troubles or questions. Number two, when they came to him and he said, hey, give me your earrings, give me all these things, and he sculpted this calf. And then he said, Aaron said this with his own mouth, he said, tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. And we think, well, that doesn't even fit. Why did he even say that? He's just joking around, right? We need to find out why. And number three, they offered burnt offerings and they offered peace offerings. And in just a short explanation of that, burnt offerings symbolize surrender to God. And peace offerings were signs of fellowship with God. And I believe these people knew that. They knew what they were doing. They were offering these offerings for a reason. And so it appears like these offerings were done in an attempt to reconnect with God. Unger's Bible Dictionary tells us in this information about Eastern methods in worship, and specifically in relation to calf worship. And I quote this from Unger's Bible Dictionary. It says, this was evidently a representation of Yahweh as the God of their deliverance from Egypt. It seems scarcely possible that this incident represents bull worships witnessed in Egypt, for there the bull was a living animal. Among many Eastern nations, there is evidence of the worship of the bull as the emblem of strength and the symbol of generative power. This certainly cannot mean that the people worshiped the image itself, but rather they thought of Yahweh enthroned invisibly above the calf. In the surrounding nations, deities were nearly always represented as standing on the back of an animal or as on a throne borne by animals, but never as the gods themselves in animal form. Now, I hope you followed that. Does that change this picture of what we get of these Israelites just going directly into pagan worship? It says there in the Bible Dictionary that what it's trying to say is that even pagan worship did not worship the animal itself. They worshiped in a way, they always set some sort of deity on the back of those bulls. And they said, that's our God. Could it be that a simple gold calf without any form there, without any form on the back of that golden calf that they created, could it be that they, in their minds, had a spot reserved for God on the back of that bull, that golden calf, and could have it represented to them the power of the God that had delivered them from Egypt? You know, God had recently just told them about the tabernacle and how he would dwell there between the two cherubims. And he said, "You're not going to see me, but I'm going to be there." Could it be that envisioning him above this riderless calf, in the same way that they envisioned him in the temple, in the tabernacle, to them placed God in the strength of the most, or in the spot of the most strength and the stamina that they knew how to portray? Could it be that 40 days, nearing 40 days of Moses' absence, this person that had this leader that had been to them their direct connection to God, the one that talked with God and brought them God's message, nearing 40 days of absence, could it be that they were becoming desperate for this symbol of power and direction and something that they could see and feel? And finally, is it possible that you and I would resort to such measures in times that we perceive that God has withdrawn from us, or when we don't feel clear direction from Him? Hebrews 11 verse 1 says, "Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen." How many times in my life, in your life, do you need a golden calf erected so that you can be assured that God is still real, that He is who He says He is? You know, it's the inherent nature of mankind to believe that we must have something to see and to feel in order to believe. We're just geared that way. And God says, the only way that you can please me is through faith. He says, without faith, it's impossible to please God. And I'm afraid too often that when we feel God has been silent for too long, that we begin to demand this golden calf to be erected. And we look at this story back here and we say, how in the world could they do that? But we feel like, I think I can find this in my own life, but we feel that we need something to reassure us that God is still the God that we read about. And so, if our faith is lacking, we do this, I believe. We place something there between me and God to prove that God is still real. We erect a calf to worship God through. Something that we can see and feel. Something that we can prove that God is real, right? We run through this list in our minds sometimes. And sometimes we even say it out loud. We tie proof of God to tangible things. And we might say it like this. We say, you know, we know God is real because look what He's always blessed us with. Look what He's blessed me with: a good business, a nice house, a healthy family, or, you know, you put in there whatever might fit. Whoa. These are definitely blessings from God, but this isn't proof that God is all powerful and that He is still God. Remember, it's in Hebrews 11 verse 1, He says it's through the things that we can't see that God proves Himself. And this is a very dangerous thing to do, because if we place the burden of proof on tangible blessings, then our faith, if we can call it that in this situation, will depart just as quickly as these blessings go away. You know, I think about the story of Job back in Job came before God and he said, hey, have you considered my servant Job down there? And he said, yeah. He said, I've been watching him. And he said, you just an upright man. You really can't pick him apart at all, can you? You can't really accuse him to me. And Satan, you know, if Job would have had this improper perspective in his life, what Satan said about him would have been true. He told God, he said, yes, but touch what he has and he'll curse you to his face. See, that's what happens when we put these things in between us and God. We look up to God. We look up to God for proof that he's still there. And we see our houses and our lands and our family. And we see these tangible things. And we say, yeah, we know you're still there, God, because that's what you've given us. And we can see it. We can easily see your blessings in our lives. And God said, you can't worship me. You can't please me. The only way you can please me is through things not seen. That's the way faith works. Romans 1:25, it tells us that we can quickly begin to worship the creature more than creator. It's a direct warning to us. Be careful. Be careful. You're going to go and do the exact same things that the Israelites did. You're going to be careful. If you have these things and you start to focus on them, you're going to start to worship the creature more than me. We tend to do no better than these Israelites if we don't pay attention. It quickly changes from showcasing God's power into this quick slide towards worshiping like the heathens do, and materialism. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 7. There's a verse there that is instructional for us. And it references this situation back here. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 7. It says, neither be ye idolaters as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And so this slide from dedicating the day to the Lord to offering offerings to eating and drinking and then rising to play can start to feel familiar to us if we need a calf erected in order to worship. It seems that that's our inherent nature to just continue to go that way. In other words, if our only reason is to trust God is because of what he's given us, then our lifestyle, I believe, will quickly follow right into the way the world lives. We'll view these blessings as our rights and instead of privileges that God would rather want us to use for his kingdom. Now, one more thing in closing that I want to consider. Do we worship at the same altars as the world, with the only difference being, like the Israelites, that we don't place the specific deities on top? We say, hey, we're not specifically, yeah, that's my house out there, but I'm not, you know. In other words, the world worships the things that they have, and they put them out there, and that is what they care about. We don't say that. We don't come out and say that our beautiful houses or our families or the things that God has given us, you know, we would never say that we worship those things. But is it our proof that God is still real in our lives? Do we use that connection, that object between us and God, to say, yeah, that's God, I know you're up there. This is what you've done for me. I know that this is real. You know, we like to say that we reserve that spot for God, but it's not how God wants to be worshipped to begin with. He knows how fast our focus will shift from that object, or from him to that object, because it's what we can see and feel. We're so inclined to acknowledge what we can see and feel and to latch onto that. And I ask us a question, can those looking on from a distance, and especially our children, see a clear path to God through our worship? Is there some object that stands in the way? Can they see that their dad worships God because of that? Because of his business. And mom worships God because of her nice kitchen. And what would happen if dad and mom would lose the business and the kitchen? What would happen then? Would they still worship God? What if those objects would go away? Are they still going to worship God? I think our children could answer that question for us, probably better than we would like to admit. So we have to ask ourselves, if this was taken away from me, would I survive spiritually and still believe in a great God? Or do I need a golden calf to be erected to survive spiritually? And so finally, as we think about this deacon ordination and we think about materialism, a couple final questions. If I need a golden calf erected for me to be able to continue to worship God, how does that affect my contribution to a church, to a brotherhood? And finally, Where and how we worship defines whether I will see my possessions and my resources as resources to build the kingdom, or whether my attitude can simply be described as materialistic. And may God help us as we ask Him to search our hearts and to find our way through these things that we can see and feel, and to put Him in His proper place. Let's kneel for prayer.